Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. In this episode, I'm joined by Google research scientist Ryan Poplin, who recently co-authored the paper Prediction of Cardiovascular Risk Factors from Retinal Fundus Photographs via Deep Learning. In our conversation, Ryan details his work training a deep learning model to predict various patient risk factors for heart disease, including some surprising ones like age and gender. We also dive into some interesting findings he discovered with regards to multitask learning, as well as his use of attention mechanisms to provide explainability. This was a really interesting discussion that I'm sure you'll enjoy. Before we get to the show, this past Saturday, I spent some time at the Scaled Machine Learning Conference, which was held on the Stanford campus in Palo Alto. I had a great time, heard some great speakers, met a few listeners, and tweeted a ton. So for more on my thoughts from the conference, head on over to my Twitter feed at Sam Charrington. This week, I'm at NVIDIA's GTC conference, so be sure to hit that follow button for more news and views. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I've got Ryan Poplin on the line. Ryan is a research scientist at Google and the lead author on the recent paper, Prediction of Cardiovascular Risk Factors from Retinal Fundus Photographs via Deep Learning. Ryan, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved and interested in machine learning. What's your background?
Sure. I'm a computer scientist by training. And what really drew me to machine learning was this idea that I could have an impact in a variety of scientific domains through statistics and through knowing about computer science and machine learning. And it allows me to sort of apply these methods to a variety of domains without having to sort of derive, you know, domain expert features about these problems.
And so did you have a formal education in AI? How did you kind of come up to speed on the tools and techniques that you use today?
Right. So I did a bachelor's degree in computer science in Indiana. This was at the Rose Holman Institute of Technology, where I studied computer science and mathematics. And then for graduate work, I was at Carnegie Mellon University, where I was in a pretty fun computational neuroscience program, which was a fun way to combine sort of stats, computer science, and the study of neuroscience. So that's sort of where I picked up the statistical machine learning techniques.
Awesome. And does your work today, do you spend a lot of time applying the machine learning in neuroscience and related fields, or do you work pretty broadly, across domains?
Right. So I like to work broadly across a variety of domains. So I've been having fun, you know, applying these methods, which are pretty general, to problems in genomics, problems in medical imaging, which is the subject of this paper, and a variety of other scientific domains.
Awesome. Awesome. So why don't we get started by having you tell us a little bit about this paper?
Sure. Yeah. So this was an effort to using the UK Biobank, which is this set of fundus photography images that were annotated with patient metadata, tried to take those images, send them through a neural network, and try to see what we could predict from it. And what we found was actually quite surprising. You could predict quite a wide variety of aspects of a person's health just by looking at this fundus photo.
Why don't we get started by talking about what is a fundus?
Yeah, sure. So a fundus photograph is a pretty routine thing, actually, that I'm sure most of the listeners of this show have actually had taken themselves. So it's simply a picture of the back of the eye. So, you know, a specialist would use a camera called a fundoscope. They take a picture of the back of the eye, and that's the retina. So if you go to the ophthalmologist, you probably have this taken routinely kind of once a year.
So is this the thing that happens when they like blow the burst of air in your eye?
Not quite. It is a camera. So it's just a normal, picture. It's actually very pleasant and non-invasive. You simply take a picture of the back of the eye. You can see in the image, you can see things like the optic disc and blood vessels sort of emanating out of that. And doctors use this to look for a wide variety of eye diseases. And what we're showing in this paper is that you can look at other diseases as well.
Awesome. So one of the things that I gleaned from the paper was that, I've seen a bunch of articles about the paper, and they all kind of focus on your ability to predict some interesting cardiovascular risk factors. But one of the things that seemed most interesting was that, and that didn't get picked up in a lot of these articles, is that you didn't really go in with a direct correlation between a lot of the things that you were able to predict in the data set, meaning, it wasn't already known that looking at these retinal images, you could predict things like age and gender and stuff like that. But you discovered that through the research. Is that the correct interpretation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we started, the background work from my current team is that we've been using these images to look at a variety of eye diseases. So predicting diabetic retinopathy, for example, at the level of accuracy of a doctor. And so when we started using this data set, that's exactly where we started, was trying to predict, look at eye diseases. And then what we noticed is that there's a wide variety of metadata about the patient available in this data set. And so we sort of added those variables to the model in really kind of a diagnostic kind of way. So these are things like age and gender and all kinds of other things. And we felt like those variables, they should be very high fidelity in the data set, because it's very easy to measure someone's age or ask their gender. And so we felt like it was a great sort of control or ground truth that we could add to the model. But then what we discovered as we were training the model was actually we were able to predict these things with remarkably high accuracy. And in fact, in the beginning, we thought it was a bug in the model. It was a problem because, you look at a gender AUC of 0.97 and you show that to someone and they say to you, you must have a bug in your model, because there's no way you can predict that with such high accuracy, right? And you can't ignore an AUC of 0.97, especially when the classes are balanced. This is quite a robust prediction from the model. And in fact, as we dug more and more into it, we discovered that this wasn't a bug in the model. It was actually a real prediction.
And so drill in a little bit more on the kind of that, the realization. I'm imagining that what I'm hearing you say is that you started by actually using this, the things that you ultimately found you could predict as features of your model, so as inputs. And then, at some point along the way, you found out that they were highly dependent on the images themselves. Is that kind of the way it came about?
Sort of. So the input to the model was always simply the images in the fundus. So always using the pixels of the image. And then alongside it, though, you can predict many things simultaneously. And actually what we found just through our research is that when you give the model many, many things to predict simultaneously, it actually does better overall. It's sort of like giving the model something to do with all of its capacity. And so as a result, we would throw in things like, why don't you try to predict the age, the gender, and actually all kinds of other things that we thought it probably couldn't predict. So it would serve as a nice control. But in reality, what we found is it's doing quite well. And so we started with gender. That was a very surprising one. And we realized that it in fact was a real prediction. It was actually doing such a good job. And then we discovered age. And here it's slightly a different prediction. You're regressing to a floating point value. And what we found is that age, you were actually correct within something like 3 years of the person's actual age, which was just remarkable. Mm-hmm. Because when we talked to doctors, they would tell us, sure, I can tell the difference between an old eye or a young eye. But then we tell them we're actually able to tell you the age within 3 years. And they're quite surprised by that.
Yeah. So you said something in passing that I wanted to drill in on a bit. You found that the model was, you improved the model. Maybe you can be more specific or kind of restate what you said. But it sounded like you were saying you improved the model's overall performance across a bunch of measures. Like each time you asked it to do something new, it got better overall. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. So this is called multitask learning. What we found is that So given a fixed model, as you add more and more features that you want it to predict, you're sort of giving the model something to do, or letting it use its capacity. And so it has a tendency, it can't possibly overfit because it's being asked to predict so many things. And as a result, you sort of improve the performance of the model overall.
Oh, interesting. And you didn't apply necessarily or go out of your way to apply kind of multitask learning, you know, techniques or anything like that to try to improve the performance, but rather this was just, you know, you got better performance for free by asking the model to do more stuff.
That's right. Exactly. And that's sort of a feature of this particular data set in which there are many, many metadata values that we could try to predict. You know, it probably may not work in every possible problem or every domain, but this was one in which it actually worked.
Now that you have seen this, if you're working on a problem, would one of your steps in optimization be just trying to come up with other stuff for the network to do? Like, is that a rational way of thinking about it?
It is, absolutely. And this is a technique we're applying to lots of different problems, actually. So another example where this worked really well was in our efforts to predict diabetic retinopathy. Mm-hmm. So in this case, you sort of have this grade that's given by the doctors. Are you one of these five classes of the disease diabetic retinopathy? But there's all kinds of other things you can predict about the image, such as, is it the image quality? So would the grader say that this is a high quality image or a low or an unusable image? Or things like, is this a left eye or a right eye, which is, you know, not that useful of a prediction, but adding this extra stuff into the model actually helped it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. I had a note to ask about kind of right versus left eye, and I didn't see that mentioned in the paper at all. Did that come into play at all in this recent mm-hmm. paper?
Yeah, so that's another feature that we try to predict alongside of, you know, age and gender and smoking status. You also predict, is this an image of a left eye or a right eye?
Okay. And now how arbitrary can you get with this? Like, could you, for example, I guess you'd need a label, but could you come up with, you know, some arbitrary metric like the vascular density of a retina image or, you know, the color shading or something like that, and try to, you know, maybe find some mechanical way to produce labels and then ask the network to try to match to that as well?
Absolutely. I think it's a very fruitful avenue of research for when you have a problem and you're trying to optimize your model to do better. I think this is one way to try that. It doesn't work in every case. Like, the features need to be sort of informative or correlative or interesting. Like, I think mm-hmm. creating synthetic features that actually aren't correlated with what you're trying to predict probably won't help as much. But it's definitely a fruitful area of research for sure.
Can you give me a sense for like the effect that this had? You know, what are we talking about in terms of performance lift ultimately? You know, is this, you know, a few percent, or is this, you know, how significant is it?
Right. It's something like a few percent. These are the kind of things where when you're sort of at the middle to the end of a project and you're trying to eke out, you know, all the possible gains in a data set, this would be a strategy to try to use. You know, it's not going to transform the problem because ultimately all you're learning are sort of the correlations between the features anyway. Mm-hmm. But it does, you know, help a couple percent. And there are many other techniques that we try to use to try to eke out that kind of last percent in model performance.
Mm-hmm. So I guess as often happens here, I kind of, you know, augured into a particular interesting detail, but we got a little bit off of track in talking about the project as a whole. So one of the things that I noticed, in addition to predicting, you know, developing this model that predicted all of these factors, as well as the kind of core factors that you were looking at, the cardiovascular risk factors, you also tried to address the explainability challenge that is often faced by deep learning models. Can you talk a little bit about how you did that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so as you mentioned, it's often the case that criticism of these kinds of models is that they're so-called black boxes. And I think there's a very long and growing body of research showing that these models are actually shouldn't be called black boxes. They're actually quite explainable in many different ways. And the technique that we used here is called soft attention. And so the idea is to create a network such that you're sort of successively zooming in on the pixels, and then you kind of ask the model, which were the pixels that made you make that prediction? And then you can project those pixels onto the original image and get an idea for why the model made the choice that it did. And so when we did that with this paper, we looked at a variety of cardiovascular risk factors and created these heat maps of, you know, what were the pixels in the image that led you to make that prediction. And what we found was actually pretty cool. So there are some predictions in which predominantly the blood vessels were the informative features. And so you could sort of see these as in the paper, we use these green heat maps, and they sort of snake along and follow the blood vessels as they're emanating out of the optic disc. And so a few of those predictions in particular are the prediction of the age and the prediction of the blood pressure. And so the blood pressure makes a lot of sense. If you want to predict the blood pressure, you need to look at the blood vessels.
Sure.
And then the other predictions, so for example, the gender prediction, were actually focused on quite different features. So there we saw things like the macula and the size of the optic disc. And when you go back and like show these images to doctors, they can sort of, you know, provide feedback and sort of back up some of these findings. So when you show these heat maps to doctors about gender, they say, oh yeah, there's this research about the ratio of the sizes of the optic disc and the caliber of the blood vessels as they emanate out, and that's predictive of gender. And so this sort of gives a bit of validity to the predictions, and also makes people feel much more comfortable.
Mm. When you're applying this soft attention mechanism, are you ultimately training kind of multiple models in parallel, or is it, you know, one big network that has a bunch of different outputs?
Yes. So in this particular case, it's two separate networks. We used the Inception V3 architecture to do the majority of the predictions, and that network has the highest AUCs and the best accuracy. And then we train a separate model, which is this smaller soft attention model, to do the model explanation. For this particular paper, that was done just because the Inception architecture had a better performance, and we wanted to report the best performance. But it could have been the same model doing both, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. So it is sort of a question of like what the goal of the prediction is. So if your goal is to be able to show these heat maps and sort of give an idea to someone of why you made these predictions, then maybe a network like the soft attention network is the way to go. And the accuracy is actually only slightly worse than if you use a much bigger model like the Inception V3.
Okay. And did you test a bunch of different models, or did you start with, start and finish with Inception, with some prior knowledge that it would probably perform the best?
Right. So in terms of broad like architecture, what we found is that pretty much in every problem that we try, the Inception architecture simply works the best. And so it's hard to move away from it because it seems to predominantly always work the best. You know, and this is the network that's, running lots of products and all around Google, such as Google Photos and things. And so it's simply the case that when you send it a lot of images, that architecture seems to do the best. Now, there's lots and lots of hyperparameter optimizations that can be done to that network. Things like, the sizes of things as you grow out the layers and all kinds of things that we definitely explored as part of this work. But predominantly the Inception architecture seems to work the best across a wide variety of problems. And that's true not only in medical imaging, it's also working for us in genomics and radiology and other things.
One of the other things I noticed was that you use transfer learning here. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's a pretty standard technique nowadays for when you don't have as much training data as you would like. And so there's actually a benefit to training this model on cats and dogs and pictures of flowers and buildings and things, and then starting from those weights and telling the model, forget about cats and dogs now and actually learn about retinas. And now you're going to start from those weights, but still update as you look at millions and millions of retinas.
Yeah, it sounds like the fact that helped you, bootstrap your training process, that's not a surprise. You do that a lot as well.
Yeah, so that technique is used actually quite a bit across products here and across products basically everywhere now. And it's a small boost. Certainly having more retinas, pictures of retinas would be way better than having pictures of cats and dogs. But it is the fact that these retinas are actually closer to natural images than they are to random images. And so you do get some boost by training on doing this pre-training on other data sets.
Yeah, I had a conversation with someone recently. I forget the specific context. We didn't have a chance to go into a lot of detail, but he made kind of a passing comment that transfer learning, you know, almost like transfer learning had been debunked or something like that, or it doesn't work in practice. Clearly, you know, it does for these kinds of problems, and you see it a lot. Do you have any, you know, care to guess at what that might be referring to? Have you seen frustrations in applying it to certain types of problems or anything like that?
Yeah, a couple of things. So one is that the benefit you're going to get is actually much, much smaller than you would like. It's not like you're adding millions of more training points to your data set. You're actually, it's a much smaller factor, because it is the fact that you want these models to be optimized to learn about retinas, right? Mm-hmm. And the patterns in retinas. But it's just a matter of sort of bootstrapping those image-like features in maybe the lower layers of the network, and you just sort of get some benefit from that. So that's the first thing, is that the benefit's actually much smaller than you would hope for. The next thing is, it kind of depends on how close your problem is to the problem of these natural images. So, for example, if your data set is sort of synthetic images or experimental images or things that don't look like pictures of cats and dogs, then it will help much, much less.
Mm-hmm. And that, I would expect that to be the case with these retinal images, but you kind of characterize them as being similar in some ways. Is it just kind of the naturalness of the image as opposed to, for example, like a computer generated image?
Exactly. So these definitely aren't random images. These are they have lighting features that you could maybe learn. They have they certainly have color correlations and spatial correlations that you could learn. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's the case that these images are closer to natural images than to just sort of starting from random weights. Yeah.
And when you say writing features, do you mean like metadata, like capture time and maybe capture location or things like that, that are kind of burned into the image?
It could be, because these are, these are cameras. A fundoscope is a camera. And so mm-hmm. there are definitely camera related artifacts that you could probably learn and pick up on, even if they were, this camera versus other camera images of natural images.
Maybe I misheard you when you said writing. If in fact that there were like optical, characters writing on these images, like the, patient name or whatever, would you have thought to do, either mask those, or, do you worry about the network learning, like, I don't know, times, time of year, mm-hmm. Types of names, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so definitely when you're working with medical images, that's something to definitely worry about. So we have this process by which we try to de-identify those images. So we mm-hmm. would first run it through a process to sort of ask, is there writing on the image? Is one common way to do it. So,
okay.
And these are standard sort of like OCR kind of techniques. Like, do you see any kind of writing? What is the writing? And if there is, we would mask that out. Yeah.
Interesting. And then with regard to the transfer learning, you mentioned kind of using the using a network trained on ImageNet and kind of bootstrapping with the weights from that network. I've also talked to folks about kind of what I guess is another kind of transfer learning, where you're kind of training a network and then kind of chopping off the last layers and replacing the last layers with something else that's more specific to your domain. Do you, I guess this is a bit of an aside, but are there kind of more specific names for each of those two things, or would you call them both transfer learning?
I think they're both called transfer learning. We do that procedure as well, where we're chopping off, if you have a network trained on thousands of classes, such as cats and dogs and buildings and flowers, then it's natural to sort of chop off that last layer and add sort of, predictions for, you know, gender, which is, you know, a classifier prediction, and then age, which is a floating point regression prediction. And you sort of add these extra layers to the top of the network. And then those layers have to be pre-initialized with sort of random weights. So those things definitely need to be learned as you optimize the network. But I think in both cases, it's sort of called transfer learning. And there are lots of other machine learning techniques we try to do to augment the data, things like random flipping of the images and brightness, random brightness changes and things. And these are ways to sort of augment your training data in small ways.
And I imagine that you have a standard kind of script or a pipeline that you send images through that does all this, or do you more kind of hand apply these things on a problem by problem basis?
By now it's somewhat standard because these techniques like, you know, flipping and rotations and brightness changes, those can be applied to any kind of image, whether it's an image of a retina or other things. And so those techniques are pretty standard, and everything we've done is built on top of TensorFlow, and these are using TensorFlow ops to do those image manipulations. Mm-hmm. But the code is shared amongst many, many teams here now.
And so if things like flipping and changing brightness and the like, are you also doing like kind of random crops and that kind of stuff? Is, you know, how many or how big is this pipeline of kind of augmentation operations? Is it a handful or is it a bunch of things?
It's quite extensive. It can be a bunch of things. It sort of depends a little bit on the problem domain. So just one example is for us, the random crops and things didn't quite work out as well because the camera image is actually pretty standard in terms of its size and its field of view and things. Mm-hmm. Because it's a patient setting where the patient puts their face into the camera, and so the field of view is actually pretty set. And these images are taken by, you know, professional ophthalmologists. And so that kind of stuff. So adding crops doesn't quite help as much. So it's a matter of sort of capturing the natural variability of the training data. And so those sort of augmentations can be turned on or off depending on what your problem domain is.
You briefly mentioned the data sets and kind of how that data was sourced. In the paper, I recall you mentioning one of the data sets, the UK data source, but in the paper you mentioned two, one from the UK and one from the US.
That's right, yeah. So we started primarily by looking at the UK biobank because this was a pretty fun data set that had lots and lots of metadata about the patient. And then when we wanted to sort of validate these predictions, we used another data set called the IPACS data set, which is a set of images from a U.S. Teleophthalmology service where, these images are sent out. They're graded by professional ophthalmologists, and they also had some of the same metadata associated with it. And so we could validate some of these predictions.
One of the things that I noticed in the paper was that you, in reporting performance and results and the like, you always treated these data sets separately. And I was wondering whether you, for example, combined the data sets and evaluated performance on, or trained on the combined data set and evaluated performance on kind of a randomized sample from these data sets, you know, and or kind of what your general thinking is about that whole line of thought.
Yeah, so we had to be a little bit careful here because some of the data sets had some of the variables and others didn't. So just for an example, systolic and diastolic blood pressure, those were available in UK Biobank. And so we trained on those, but they aren't available in IPACS. And so we couldn't report the results there. We actually, we couldn't train a model on that because that data wasn't available. And so that's one reason why it's sort of very carefully split between the two things.
Like only age is common to the two data sets.
And gender, yeah.
Age and gender, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so, that's just an unfortunate feature of the data. We're still working on trying to collect other data sets which have these other metadata available. One cool thing about the IPACS data set, though, is they had HbA1c level measured for their patients. Mm-hmm. And so this is a measure of blood glucose. And so it was really cool to be able to try to predict that. But that feature is not available in UK Biobank. So we had to play a little bit there.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like that was the the only feature that, you know, for which you didn't consistently outperform the baseline. Is that right? And what's your intuition around that?
Yeah, so I think the mean is sort of slightly better than the baseline, but if you look at 90% confidence intervals, they're basically overlapping. And so what I think it's saying is that there are some features in the images which are correlated with HbA1c, but you know it's not a slam dunk prediction that you would want to sort of bet the house on.
Mm-hmm. As is the case with age, where you've got this very accurate set of predictions.
Right, exactly. And we try to be very careful about producing the 95% confidence intervals to give someone an idea of how accurate we thought these predictions were and whether they were actually, predicting something real or just sort of regressing to the mean values in the data set.
Mm-hmm. And how did you produce the confidence intervals and the p-values and the statistical measures like that that you mentioned in the paper?
Mm-hmm. So all the confidence intervals are done through bootstrapping of the eval set. So you sort of randomly select from that eval set many, many times. And then from that, you have a distribution of AUC values. And then you can report the 95% confidence interval of those. And that's true for the AUCs and also the mean squared errors and things.
Awesome. You and Google more broadly alone are doing a ton of work in this area, specifically applying deep learning to not just image-based predictions, but, healthcare predictions more broadly. But in the, starting specifically with the domain of image-based predictions and diagnostics, what's your sense of what the, where are we, I guess, is the question. What are the limitations? What are we able to do very well right now? And kind of what do you think the path is to making this kind of a standard tool in the physician's toolkit?
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I think that we're able to do very well right now in the medical imaging domain is to automate the diagnoses of diseases in which doctors can sort of look at an image, give you a diagnosis, and be very confident in their diagnosis. So from that data, we can sort of collect many, many diagnoses from doctors, train models to replicate that performance, and sort of automate that doctor-level diagnostics and make it sort of radically available, throughout the world, in which the people may not have access to that level of expert care. Mm-hmm. The places where we're still need work are in the sort of more researchy or experimental type predictions like the ones we're talking about here, in which we've shown that there's like some tantalizing correlations, but the data sets, they only have a couple hundred cardiovascular events, for example. And so we aren't able to prove that we're able to predict these things at high accuracy, but there's sort of tantalizing evidence that maybe there's something there. And so you could imagine a future in which this fundus image is actually, taken like more like a vital sign, like your blood pressure when you go into the doctor's office, where you take this snapshot of the eye. It's a very non-invasive thing, very easy to do, and you get this sort of overall view of someone's health. And so there's lots of work that needs to be done to sort of validate those predictions and those ideas. But mm-hmm. that's one area that it could go.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of making this more sort of broadly accepted or available, I think one way to do this is to focus on this explanation of the predictions and so get doctors more like on your side about the prediction. Like by providing an explanation, they sort of can trust it. They can believe in what the model is doing.
Mm-hmm. Did you, out of curiosity, did you interface directly with the doctors for this study?
Absolutely. Yeah. We work with, we have, lots of doctors that we work with through our eye disease initiatives. And then we also work with cardiologists as well to sort of bounce ideas off of them, show them early results, and sort of get their feedback on the predictions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And were there any particular, conversations or reactions that jumped out at you for, when you presented, with and without presenting, the soft attention results, did you have those the entire time, or did you have some conversations with doctors, before you had the explanations from the attention mechanisms and some after? And did you see a marked difference in kind of the way they react?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can imagine trying to show a doctor, tell them that you have an AUC of 0.97 for gender, and they kind of laugh at you. They don't believe it. But then when you show them that heat map and sort of show that it's focusing on the optic disc or maybe features around the optic disc, then they say, oh yeah, of course we knew that. That of course you can see that. And so it really does by showing where in the image the model is using to make its prediction, it really does provide a level of trust and also you know, a level of validity to the results.
Can you tell us a little bit about the broader research landscape in this area? What are, you know, you've mentioned a bunch of the research that you're doing. Where do you think the most interesting and important activity in this space is happening right now?
So the future work for the cardiovascular effort is certainly in validating in more data, so more data sets, trying to find data sets which have more cardiovascular events so we can sort of validate those approaches. And I think as we gather together more and more data, then we'll be able to, you know, narrow those confidence intervals and try to decide if this is actually working. So that's the future in that respect is certainly gathering more data. And that's true across a wide variety of domains, actually. We have a lot of initial predictions and initial results, but we need lots and lots more data in order to validate those things.
You know, that almost makes me think that the take is that, you know, we've kind of solved a lot of the machine learning bits of this. You know, we've got Inception, we've got, you know, transfer learning from ImageNet, we've got, attention mechanisms and the like to help with explainability. It sounds like you're saying that, you know, in terms of kind of core, you know, evolving the way we think about or our capabilities on the machine learning side, you know, we're kind of as far as we need to be, and now we just need more data. Is that taking it too far, or do you agree with that?
I think in terms of medical imaging, I think that's more or less true. There's still research that's happening for sure on better and more valid ways to do the model explanation, ways to incorporate many more predictions simultaneously and things like this. But I think for medical imaging, I think there's definitely a path forward that we see that is more or less guaranteed to work at this point. We've done the early work to show that it's going to work. We just need to execute. Mm-hmm. I think the areas in which it's less clear are in other domains. So things like working with medical records and things like working with genomics data and other sort of health biomedicine data.
Mm-hmm. There's still some more fundamental work that needs to happen around network architectures and machine learning models and the like.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because there you're, for example, in the medical record space, you're working with sort of time as a dimension that you need to add to the model in some way. There's a lot of unstructured notes and things. And so there's sort of a much wider variety of model architectures that are needed to be explored there for sure.
Interesting. In terms of that data challenge, how involved were you in that? Like, did you come on this project and the data was there? And it sounds like you've used this data set quite a bit. But do you have any experience trying to source this data? And does that leave you with any advice for folks that are interested in doing work in this field but need to get their hands on a data set?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So data is definitely the key. You can't do anything in this field without data. And so, you know, when this project started, it started with literally the word UK Biobank. What is there something interesting there? Yes or no? We'd have no idea. And so it was a matter of sort of starting from that with that data from scratch and sort of deciding what was in it and learning how all the different fields are encoded and learning like when the data was trustworthy and you know which fields were encoded in different ways and things. And so there's definitely a lot of work in terms of cleaning up the data, you know, parsing and downloading and making it, you know, widely available to the team and things. So there's a lot of engineering work and data science work that goes into that for sure.
Can you maybe give us a sense of the timeframes involved in a project like this? It sounds like you didn't start from a cold start, so it may be a little bit difficult because you've got, you know, certainly a tool chain in place, this data set you've worked with for a while. But in terms of, you know, starting from, the idea to research this project to publishing the paper recently. Like, what was that time frame like?
Mm-hmm. So it's something, I think, a little over a year. So it's roughly, you know, 4 to 6 months of, you know, digging through the data and deciding what's there. You know, understanding why when I load up the JPEG, it looks, you know, reversed or whatever, and learning the specifics of the encoding and things like this. You know, that takes time, diving into the data. And so that's, you know, roughly 4 to 6 months of digging in and trying things. Mm-hmm. I think our earliest predictions on the gender and AUC were within maybe 3 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. And then you dive into, then you branch out and look at these other predictions like blood pressure and BMI and cardiovascular events and things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and doing this sort of statistical analysis to prove that that was actually working, that probably took another 3 to 4 months or something. And then there's, of course, a lot of work that goes into publishing a manuscript. And so, you know, we went through rounds of peer reviews and things to get that out there.
Sure, sure. And this particular data set, the biobank data set, or either of them really, are they publicly available, or are there hoops that you needed to jump through to get access to them?
They're publicly available to qualified researchers. It's a process of applying for access and basically stating that you have a stated research goal in mind, and then they decide to grant you access to that data, and you can use it. Yeah.
Interesting. And are there other interesting data sets on your radar?
Oh, all kinds. So, just to talk about the UK Biobank again, they're currently adding genomics data to the data set, and that'll be really exciting to see what's there and what we can predict from it. And in terms of fundus imagery, there are other data collections that are available. There are these things like sort of Kaggle-like competitions or machine learning competitions, in which a few of them are on fundus imagery. And so those data sets are available.
Awesome. Well, Ryan, this has been super interesting. Do you have any final thoughts or words for folks, or anything that we didn't cover? Any questions that I should have asked?
Yeah, so it's been super fun. Thank you so much. One parting thing maybe is I'm super excited about the fact that this work was done in sort of a featureless kind of unbiased way, in which I'm certainly not an ophthalmologist and don't know anything about retinas. But we were able to sort of tell the model to use its features to learn about a patient's health. And then we surprisingly learned about, you know, a bunch of different statistical correlations that were in the data that we wouldn't have found if we had sort of went into it, like sort of presupposing what the features might be and looking at things like the width of the blood vessels or things. Mm-hmm. And so I do like that this is potentially a method of scientific discovery that could be used in the future. And people should think about trying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like a general advertisement for deep learning and, you know, kind of a data first as opposed to a feature first approach. Is that kind of where you're headed?
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, once again, Ryan, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on Ryan or any of the topics covered in this episode, you'll find the show notes at twimlai.com/talk/122. We heard from a lot of you over the weekend about our last episode on the reproducibility crisis and the philosophy of data, and we really appreciate your comments. If you want to get in on the conversation, be sure to hit us up at Sam Charrington or at TwimmelAI on Twitter, or via the show notes page, which we'll link to in the notes for this show. Thanks once again for listening, and catch you next time.